stronger grip over Parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or, many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or, many French could be too scared to protest, given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war, and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition, like malaria rather than COVID, that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Purizep, London.
A British government minister has launched a direct attack on the pro-Palestine boycott campaign against Israel, claiming that the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement fuels anti-Semitism, including hate crimes in Jewish-rich areas of London. Speaking while visiting Orthodox Jewish community leaders in North London, Community Secretary Michael Gove was quoted by a pro-Israel newspaper stating,
"The BDS campaign is not about running an ethical foreign policy. The BDS campaign is designed for only one purpose, to attack and delegitimize the state of Israel and the idea that there should be a Jewish state at all. The campaign has not only undermined efforts for peace in the Middle East, it also leads to community tension in the UK. We have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents, and the BDS campaign is a driver of that."
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. Pro-Israel groups have long lobbied British authorities to act against the practice. Those demands appear to have been answered, with plans announced to ban economic and cultural boycotts of Israel, with new anti-BDS legislation announced during the Queen's speech on May the 10th, a move slammed by pro-Palestine activists.
First and foremost, I think Israel is really concerned with its excesses against the Palestinians, and the civil society is rising up against that. This concern obviously means that the supporters of Israel want to make sure that Israel can continue with its occupation, and they want to close down all potential avenues that highlights the Israeli aggression and human rights violation. And therefore, we see the British government, the Conservative government, who is very close to Israel, to stop the British citizens from trying to carry out their democratic right.
Since the Queen's speech, several government ministers have targeted the BDS. Just last week, Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the BDS racist during a talk at a pro-Israel event. According to Mr. Gove, the anti-BDS legislation will be put forward to the House of Commons before the end of this year. The move, described as a chilling attack on democracy, will also potentially face legal challenges, meaning that the fight for Palestine here in the UK is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment, and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil, or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid.
Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian Foreign Minister, while in Davos, Switzerland, appearing at the World Economic Forum, made Iran's case when it came to the JCPOA. First, he said that an agreement on the Iran deal is possible if the U.S. makes a realistic decision. Is the U.S. ready to make a realistic decision? And what does a realistic decision even mean? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we'll try to find out what that means. We will take a look at why the U.S. continues a maximum pressure policy and things like sanctions to have incurred on Iran, including ship confiscations, and yet it does not want to deem the deal to be dead. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us, political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'm going to first start with you, Mostafa Khoshesh, because I'd like to understand what Iran's foreign minister meant when he said, quote, now we have reached a point during the negotiations that if the American side makes a realistic decision, an agreement would be within reach. I'm curious as to what you think he means by that realistic decision referral.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, this has been the case for the past 2-3 months. Before the Russians raised concerns about the future of the deal, some problems started because the Americans started buyer's remorse on a couple of issues. The number one issue was the red sanctions list. I'll explain about it later if necessary. And then the removal of the IRGC from the foreign terrorist organizations list. And also, a third issue pertains to one specific category of guarantees. Iran has requested guarantees, four types of guarantees: nuclear guarantees, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees. And now there has remained some one or two of these issues. People are well acquainted with the kind of guarantee Iran has requested from the Congress. Iran has said that either the Congress should endorse any future deal, or the Speaker of the Senate or the Speaker of the House should issue some kind of statement in support of a deal. And all of it is because the U.S. has violated the deal. It has proved to be irresponsible. If a deal comes up, common sense rules for receiving as many guarantees as possible from the United States, that's one of the main necessary issues that Europeans have requested Iran, I mean, European companies, as well as Asian companies. One of the high-level diplomats in Tehran was telling me some 2-3 months ago that if Iran expects us to return for investment in Iran, we do not agree with whatever guarantee the U.S. gives unless one specific type of guarantee, and that's economic guarantee to you and to us, that states that the U.S. would respect our contract. Investment contracts are long, like 10, 20 years. So for the entire duration and lifetime of that contract, no matter what happens to the JCPOA and if it, the U.S. stays under the JCPOA or not, once it is revived. Okay. So this has been requested by foreign companies. And before dealing with the IRGC issue, these sanctions and guarantees issues are highly important to economic interests that Iran should receive from any kind of revival of the JCPOA. And one more sentence. What Amir Abdullahian said, the U.S. should take a realistic look, means that instead of going for, media hype and, hues and cries about IRGC's removal from the FPO list, they know that before we come to that point, specific point, they need to resolve issues with regard to the sanctions and guarantees. They are hiding that. They have tried to derail public attention to the IRGC issue. That means they are just playing. They are not working for real solution of the problem in order to have a deal.
Do you agree with that, the fact that the U.S. is doing that, Scott Ritter, that there are... Well, let me use the words of the foreign minister, Abdullahian, before I get an answer from you. Quote, the U.S. blacklisting of IRGC is only a secondary issue, nation's top priority. In fact, IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups, a secondary issue has been magnified by the pro-Israeli lobby. And our main priority is the interest of the Iranian nation. That's what the foreign minister has said in Davos. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, that the issue of the sanctioning of the IRGC is a purely political move by the United States. It has no practical impact on Iran's nuclear program, on the JCPOA as a whole. It was done under pressure from members of Congress who are themselves under pressure from the the pro-Israeli lobby here in the United States and the Israeli government itself. But I'll take a step back. I remember reading about the deliberations of the Iranian parliament in the lead up to the finalizing the JCPOA in July of 2015. And there's some very, very difficult discussions. The Iranians knew up front that the United States was not a trustworthy partner because it's there in black and white. They said so. And the Iranians were looking for assurances at that time that the U.S. could be trusted to stay the course. And it turns out that the Iranians were right, that the U.S. is not a trustworthy partner. And it's not just Trump that betrayed the agreement. In April of 2015, prior to the JCPOA being finalized, Barack Obama, the hero of the JCPOA, gave an interview to National Public Radio where he said, issues like the sunset clauses are not carved in stone, meaning that once the agreement's made, the United States will come back and reconsider whether or not it wants to allow these sunset clauses to expire or if we're going to create a whole host of issues to control Iran. The United States has no intention of allowing Iran to possess a nuclear enrichment capability that the JCPOA says it's allowed to. And Joe Biden was the vice president of Obama. He has inherited that policy. And Joe Biden today, I will just state right up front, has no intention of allowing the JCPOA to reach maturity, that whatever agreement is reached now is a short-term agreement to buy time to force or compel the Iranians to backtrack some of their commitments or some of their advances that they've made in the nuclear arena while the United States works with Europe and others to find a new tactic to constrain Iran. A renewed JCPOA isn't the end of the crisis. It's just the beginning of a new crisis.
What makes you think that, though?
Because that's what the Biden administration's policy is. Listen to them. They're straight up front. They are not going to let the sunset clauses expire. They're just not.
Okay.
They will impose. One of the reasons why they don't want to have ironclad prohibition against the resumption of sanctions is that once they bring the Iranian nuclear program under the control of the JCPOA, they want to retain the ability to impose new sanctions if necessary to put pressure on Iran to make compromises in the rights that it has successfully negotiated for itself under the JCPOA. So ask any Iranian negotiator. They'll tell you that's the case.
Well, Seymour Sabahosheshma, obviously the Iranian side is very much well-versed in tactics that the U.S. has used. And at least I'm not there at the negotiating table, but I'm guessing that it's a very seasoned, well-informed team that has the experience of the previous team that was there. And what Scott Ritter says there, I'm sure they are also speculating that or using that in their calculations. So how do you go about going into the revival if you have that many doubts involved?
Well, that's exactly the point why Iranians are asking for guarantees that they would receive the merits under the deal. That's why they do not agree to go beyond the JCPOA. They were already stressed in response to the Biden administration's repeated demands for going to JCPOA over Iran's missile power, over Iran's regional power. And God knows the list continues, and God knows when and where they want to put an end to this long list of Iran's power components that they want to harness, that they want to contain. You know, they don't have any kind of problem with Iran's nuclear power. They got a problem with Iran's power as a regional power. That's what they want. They are not for a conflict resolution in there. Iran and the U.S. have, or its allies, they have signed six agreements over Afghanistan, Iraq, three atomic accords with the Europeans, the Troika of Europe, from 2001 to 2005, altogether five agreements. And the sixth one with the JCPOA. In all of them, Americans admit that Iran has been completely loyal to its undertakings. Why? Because Iran wanted a conflict resolution and believed that the other side is there for a conflict resolution. But the Americans had only one major undertaking, removing the sanctions, and they never did that because they are not there for conflict resolution. They are there for their containment strategy that includes using carrot and stick policy in order to slow down Iran's progress in various areas of power, in the nuclear industry, in the missile power, regional power, drone power, and so on and so forth, then stop Iran's growth and then start a rollback in order to push back Iran's growth. Now, Iranians know it pretty well, but they want to show their good intentions, but they are no fools. They have the lessons received under the administration of President Rouhani. They know Americans are not a responsible party, and they should receive guarantees. That's exactly one of the major points under discussion, under debate. But Americans do not want to discuss it. They want to just do some kind of media show and claim that the two sides are in trouble over only one single issue, while this has never been the case since February.
Well, we're still looking at officials from Iran who are making a case for this, Scott Ritter, and also the Americans who don't want this to be dead because they're saying that it's still the best viable option. Whether you're talking about the U.S. Secretary of State or you're talking about the special envoy, Robert Malley. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Abdollahian, and another quote from him that I want to get your reaction from, is that Iran must avail themselves of the full economic advantages of the JCPOA. The talks have been going on for quite some time. Is Iran looking to see a cycle be completed in the midst of the time that has elapsed from the beginning until now? And perhaps there's a test that's going on so that it could then draw a conclusion as to now is the right time to finalize the talks? Are we looking at a certain scenario of that kind?
Look, I think if Iran could get the guarantees from the United States, although I would caveat it, and I'm sure the Iranians believe the same, because they don't trust America, nor do they have a reason to trust America. But America will not comply with any agreement they make with Iran. That's absolutely certain. Even if Iran gets all they want, statements from, read the Constitution. A statement from the Speaker of the House is meaningless. A statement from the Senate Majority Leader is meaningless. The Constitution is the only thing that matters, and the only way to make an Iranian agreement with the United States on the JCPOA, one that the United States must adhere to, is for the Senate of the United States to ratify a treaty, a formal treaty. Anything less than that makes this an executive decision made by a president that, while it may have the force of law while the president's in power, if he's replaced by another president who disagrees, like Donald Trump, it will renege it. And this is what's going to happen, because the United States is not going to give up the capability to snap back inspections in the future. The United States is trading off the promise of immediate economic gain for Iran, short-term economic gain, so that Iran will sign, will agree to the terms that the U.S. has put out there. The U.S. will come back to the JCPOA, and everything will be fine until we get to the issues of the expiration of the sunset clauses. Then the United States will start to raise new issues, and when Iran refuses to depart, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions all over again. That's a reality.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another issue that we need to talk about, because it's always there.
May I add something in reference to this battery there? Yeah. Scott, that's why Iranians actually worked out a long list of guarantees. You know, from these four types of guarantees, three of them, I mean, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees, they all depend on the U.S. goodwill in compliance with, you know, its endorsement. And we do know that the United States, as you said, would not act in compliance and in goodwill. That's why the first type of guarantees that they call essential guarantees or nuclear guarantees, you know, they were the first that Iran worked and ensured to have, because it depends on Tehran, not on the U.S. compliance. But it's the only type of guarantee that Iran can rely on, because it stays under Iran's power. What is it? When you keep your highly advanced centrifuge machines in store, sealed under the IAEA, but inside Iranian territory, under Iranian control, without dismantling. Number two, if you keep your materials, nuclear materials, intact in Iran, store them here. Number three, if you keep your know-how, nuclear know-how that you have earned intact and without any pause in continuing these studies, then you can ensure that if the U.S. starts defying the nuclear deal, if it is revived ever, then you don't lose anything. You will not sustain damage or losses.
Can we get Scott Ritter to react to that?
That's a deterrent factor. That's a deterrent factor against, one more sentence, that's a deterrent factor against the United States defiance, because that means if you just go astray, if you defy the accord and your undertakings, we start doing the same thing, the 60% enrichment, and maybe we will start 90% enrichment.
There you go. Okay, Scott Ritter, so he's got a valid point there. What would the U.S. do? Would it risk that?
Again, I don't trust anything. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't trust any agreement that the United States... Look, Iran's not stupid. They've been betrayed before, and I understand the intent of these nuclear guarantees. You know, but Joe Biden is dealing with domestic American politics as much as he's dealing with, you know, international security or, you know, geopolitical issues. And Biden is going to, if he's going to... re-enter the JCPOA, it's only going to be because he gets some sort of political boost here at home. No matter what the United States agrees to, Iran needs to understand that the policy of the United States mirrors the policy of Israel, and that Iran cannot be allowed to have a functioning, modern, capable nuclear enrichment capability, and that they are going to do whatever they can to ensure that in the long term, Iran doesn't get this. Now, they may make some compromises up front for political reasons to rejoin the JCPOA. Israel right now is saying that at least some people are quoted in the Jerusalem Post saying that a bad JCPOA is better than no JCPOA right now because it does retard Iran's progress in the nuclear enrichment field. So I think there's a lot of political impetus to get a short-term political bounce from finalizing the JCPOA, but in the long term, the United States and Israel, and maybe many of the European partners of the U.S., will be looking for ways to undermine Iran's nuclear enrichment capability going forward.
Well, since you mentioned Israel, I got to get this out of the way. Quick answer, if you can, on this, Sayyid Mostafa Hoshesh. Many analysts and headlines, I'm sure, that you're familiar with have said, was the assassination in Iran another Israeli effort to sabotage the JCPOA? Because previous killings, according to one entry, actually took place at times in Washington and Tehran, actually appear to be on the cusp of a diplomatic breakthrough, perhaps. Do you agree with that? Is that what may have happened?
First of all, Scott, we are on the same page. That's right. Just for the record, we do not trust America. We do know that the United States has never been loyal to its undertakings. They would not stay loyal to this deal. Some might ask why then we are in the talks, because we have paid our dues in cash upfront under President Rouhani. We've never received anything. 2 years, 3 years maximum is left from the JCPOA's 10-year-long period. And we are there to see if we could earn cash in, I mean, what we've been promised. If possible, good. If not, then we don't, you know, rely on that as our main foreign policy pivot. But in response to your question, I'm not from those guys who believe that the Israelis are acting so separately against their strategic partner and want to sabotage or torpedo the deal. On the contrary, I believe that when they assassinated Iranian IRGC colonel, Martir Khodai, and just 48 hours later, it's the prime minister of the Zionist regime, again, the same regime that has done the assassination, that declares officially that the U.S. will not withdraw the IRGC from the FTO list. That has a lot of meaning. That in a matter of 24 hours, there is a Senate hearing there. Menendez, the senator, and Rob Malley, the U.S. envoy on Iran, they confirmed the decision. They approved, and I mean, they endorse what Naftali Bennett has said. That means this kind of decision by the United States has been a green light to the Israelis to do the assassination. Exactly. That is to say, the Biden administration has okayed the Israeli assassination efforts. They've given a green light to go ahead with this policy in order to pressure Tehran, to remind Tehran that we have more options to harm you. Definitely, there will be a response to that. There will be retaliation. There will be escalation. The end, we believe, would not be beneficial to the Israelis and Americans.
Okay.
But American policy is also to be blamed. They are also responsible for this assassination, despite the fact that they leaked it to New York Times and tried through that article to send this message to Iran that we are clean of this assassination that has been done by the Israelis. It's not been our decision. We didn't want it. Israelis have informed us. We are not responsible. But Iran would not take that. We believe Americans are also guilty. They have blood of Colonel Khodai on their hands as well.
All right, very well. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. And let me thank, that was Sayyid Mostafa Hoshesh, their political analyst. Thank you. And former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, thank you. Spoke to us from Bethlehem, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Witawe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. In the United States, children of temporary visa holders who can't gain permanent residency in the U.S. are one of several groups urging the Biden administration to act on an immigration overhaul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aishwarya Kavi. The piece is titled, They Grew Up Legally in the U.S. but Can't Stay After They Turn 21. In 2011, after 5 years of working and living with his family in the United States on a temporary visa, Bharathi Mohan Ganesan submitted green card applications for his wife, his 5-year-old daughter, and his 11-year-old son. Mr. Ganesan, who was born in India and has also lived in Singapore and Australia, was nervous about when his wife and children might gain permanent residency of the United States. He knew the waiting list was especially long for Indians on his kind of visa, an H-1B, which allows American companies to employ skilled foreign workers. Because of chronic backlogs, it can take years to process those on work visas who apply for permanent residency. Last year, a decade after he applied, Mr. Ganesan, his wife and his daughter received their green cards. But his son had turned 21 and missed the cutoff by a matter of few months, leaving him scrambling for a visa that would allow him to stay in the United States. Mr. Ganesan's son is among more than 200,000 children who grew up in the United States under the protection of their parents' temporary visas, which can be renewed indefinitely. But the children risk losing their legal status when they turn 21. Unable to become permanent residents of the United States because of the backlogs or because they were never eligible in the first place, they must obtain a different visa, remain in the United States without legal status, or leave the country entirely. According to the Cato Institute, more than 10,000 children aged out of green card eligibility each year. Untold numbers eventually depart the United States, often leaving their families behind. These young people do not qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA program, created by executive action during the Obama administration. The DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, protects from deportation about 650,000 youths, or DREAMers, who were brought into the United States and have remained without legal status. Because the program requires applicants to be undocumented, it does not offer those with legal status a way to stay in the United States. A comprehensive immigration overhaul is highly unlikely to pass a deadlocked Congress in a midterm election year. The Biden administration has been under increasing pressure as a Trump-era public health order, known as Title 42, is set to be lifted in late May, a move that is expected to create a surge of migration across the southwestern border of the United States. A bipartisan group of senators restarted immigration discussions on Thursday, 28th of April, to try to identify standalone proposals that would have the support of both political parties. When asked on Thursday, 28th of April, whether the Biden administration, which is updating the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program, was considering extending protections to documented youth, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, told the House Judiciary Committee that the department did not plan to do so. Its focus was to fortify the existing DACA program and shift responsibility for documented youths to Congress, he said, adding that their situation spoke to the imperative to pass immigration reform. In interviews, more than a dozen people who lived in the United States on temporary visas from a young age described their struggles with anxiety and the financial burden of navigating how to remain in the country they considered home. They are urging the Biden administration, if it will not provide a path to citizenship, to offer a way for them to legally remain in the country. Mr. Ganesan's son, Niranjan Bharathimohan, is able to stay in the United States until this November only because immigration officials extended his dependent visa. Mr. Bharathimohan, a student at the University of Texas at Dallas, will have to go to Singapore, where he was born, to apply for a student visa that will allow him to return to the United States and finish his degree. His application might be rejected since he previously tried for a green card. He has shown an intent to immigrate to the United States, which is not allowed. Applicants may be asked to show that they intend to leave the country after completing their courses. Mr. Bharathimohan faces the prospect of being stuck in Singapore, where he has no family and no roots. How is he going to manage alone? Mr. Ganesan said. I was really devastated that just because of my country of birth, my son's opportunities are very limited in the United States. While there are protections to keep families together when parents move to the United States on temporary work visas, those end when children turn 21, because they are no longer considered part of the family unit. I don't think people who originally wrote the laws foresaw a situation where children brought here on visas would be raised and educated here, but not have a clear opportunity to stay and become American citizens, said Dip Patel, the founder of Improve the Dream, an organization that campaigns for a path to citizenship for those children. Dip Patel added, delay in taking action will not only lead to tearing more families apart, but also continue the immense emotional turmoil faced by thousands of families. At a Senate hearing in March, Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the top Republican on the panel's Immigration Subcommittee, vowed to work on legislation to help people who had grown up in the United States without a clear path to U.S. citizenship. Muzaffar Chishti, the director of the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law, described the issue as one of many in a system that has not been truly updated since the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which established the pathways for legal immigration to the United States that are still in place. Short of a legislative overhaul of the system, Improve the Dream, the advocacy group, has worked to increase awareness of the issue and is urging the Biden administration to make changes. But children of non-immigrant visa holders have criticized the Biden administration for being too slow or unwilling to take action on proposed changes, such as the expansion of the DACA program to include documented youths. Among the proposals is one that would modify how U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services determines whether an applicant qualifies for a green card, allowing more children and minors to remain eligible as they near the age of 21. Another would classify applicants as children beyond their 21st birthday to keep them in line for a green card, which is the policy for those who are refugees or asylum seekers or are sponsored by relatives who are U.S. citizens. Matthew Burke, a spokesman for the Immigration Agency, said the Department of Homeland Security was keenly aware of the challenges for documented youths in the United States and was exploring legal methods to provide immigration relief to this population where possible.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.